I'm Coulter DeVries, owner of Ranch Investor Advisory and Brokerage Services. I'm an accredited land consultant with the Realtor Land Institute and proud member of ASFMRA.
The Ranch Investor Podcast is the most downloaded and informative industry-specific content that intrigues while entertains.
Jason Kent, tuning in from Nevada. Thanks for tuning in again. I'm glad to have everyone on. I have a huge interest in Nevada and Eastern Oregon, not because it's where my people are located, the anti-government Bundys and Hammonds. That is my people. That is why I'm interested. But no, I just generally, it's big grazing. It's cheap grazing out there. And you might be in trouble for coming on this podcast, Jason, because I need you to divulge all your secrets today. And all the locals are going to be pissed off at you that you brought in a bunch of Californians and that you are selling out your local community and culture. But the listeners want to know your secrets today. So who is Jason Kent?
So I am a real estate broker for Inc. Realty here in Northern Nevada. I'm also a rancher. I run a regenerative agricultural business, although we are commercial beef based. As far as the secrets, I don't know that there are that many. And our grazing, I don't think is as cheap as most people think it is, especially here where we are. When I've listened to your podcast and you guys are talking about private land and what it goes for per acre in this valley where we are, oh man, if I could get land that cheap, I would, I don't know that I'd be selling real estate. But right now our average, you know, price point for a 20 acre parcel is up over $700,000. So, and that's ag land, that's grazing land. So it's, the regenerative ag thing is big because you got to find a way to make more without putting a bunch of money in. And, that's what the holistic management's all about, is how can we maximize, how can we increase stocking rates? How can we increase production without putting a bunch in? And as far as the real estate side of things, I got led into that through, I was losing leases. I was getting people coming up going, well, hey, we're going to sell. And then they go, oh, well, you can talk to the realtor about the water rights and where the utilities are on the property and all the easements that are on the property. And I'm going, wait a minute, I'm losing my lease and I'm doing somebody else's job. This is not what it's all cracked up to be. So I went and got my license and then built into being the broker, and we built a really, really amazing team of agents in our brokerage here in Northern Nevada. That being said, I wanted to come on to talk to you because you've built this business model and it's what every, I think, ranch broker idealizes, with having licenses in multiple states and learning and working with people who are crowdfunding for ranches, because fractionalizing ranches is, I believe, going to be the future of how ranches are going to be sold here, especially in Northern Nevada, with the cost being so high. You don't get the ROI that I think people are really expecting out of other commercial investments.
I've heard that before. I've heard a lot of people say, because of the low cap rate and high land cost, to get into the size of ranch a person generally wants, you're going to need three or four lifetimes to be able to afford that type of ranch. So I've heard a lot of people say that fractionalization is the future. I look at it more like, we have 330 million Americans, and everyone has a different assessment of risk and required rate of return. And granted, I do also believe that when you look at a Montana ranch and say the cap rate is 2% in eastern Montana, I think that's appropriately risk adjusted. Your alternative cost of capital or you know, your risk-free rate of borrowing through the Fed, it is higher today. So that makes a 2% cap rate less appealing than it was years ago when the Fed rates were near zero, or they were at 2%. But having no correlation to, well, historically having no correlation to systematic risk, the equities market, in theory, you don't have a risk-free requirement. That's taken out. But no, I still think that ranches are adequately valued. It's a low cap rate, but as you know, Jason, look at all the intangible benefits you get with it. Like, you have this awesome lifestyle. You get to ride horses. You make a little money on your cows. You engage with people you enjoy, and you're out there in the elements. You're out there with the wildlife. It's hard to put a value on that. I think you put a value on that, and the cap rate goes up to 10%.
I don't disagree with you. The other side of that is we're not making more land. And so the investment in ranch properties, it is a long-term play. And yeah, the cap rates on a commercial business like ranching are low, but the value for holding land, if you have the ability to hold land for a longer period of time, it's going to pay off. That being said, where we are in Northern Nevada, we've got a lot of people coming in from California. They come over the Sierras and they love seeing ranch land, open space. And our biggest issue is, I think, like everywhere, water, and how, when these ranches get broken up, the water's utilized, distributed. The grazing management practices have to change, because now we're not running up in the mountains like we used to. You know, I know you guys still have a lot of great grazing up in the mountains, but, you know, Lake Tahoe used to be grazed by cattle, and a lot of it isn't anymore. So when people talk about the, my grandparents have been here and this is the way they run it, I call bullshit, because your grandparents had cattle up in the mountains and you're just keeping stuff down in the valley floor. So the management practices change. It'll change the economics of it quite drastically as well. And because of where we're located, we're 45 minutes south of Reno, International Airport right there. You're 20 minutes from Lake Tahoe. So you're kind of in this really desirable location in a really small valley. So it's a hard place to make a real commercial ranch business go, but man, it is an incredible place to live.
Well, I think sounds like you're dealing with a lot of the same issues that Western Montana and then different pockets of the country are dealing with. Is that Truckee or is that Sparks where you're at?
So I'm south of Sparks. So Sparks and Reno are kind of right next to each other. They say Reno is so close to hell, you can see Sparks. And, but we're about 45 minutes an hour south. And then I'm actually looking up at the Sierra Nevada mountains, and right on the other side, I'm looking at Heavenly Ski Resort from here. And on the other side of that's Lake Tahoe. So we're real close to high density populations. And as those communities expand, they're expanding into these rural areas. And I don't know that the local governments are prepared for what's coming in terms of the growth of these areas and the planning, you know.
We ran into that in Montana. 2006, the housing boom, we had swindlers, con artists, fly-by-night operators, subdividers, developers. They would come into a bedroom-type community and they would launch these plans of development, subdivision, and the commissioners were good old boys. I don't even know if they had ever left Montana, and they kind of got defrauded. Everyone kind of got defrauded. These bad actors that entered the rural parts, made a pretty good margin, left with also leaving with liabilities. So gravel contractors, local fire departments, the local utilities co-op, quite often that type of boom and that new change drastically, rapidly, someone's going to be left holding the bag. And it's usually, not the experienced swindler.
Yeah, we're seeing it. The development that's happened here is just really is mind blowing, and it's happening so quickly. It's almost exponential, you know, and the, you know, I don't know what was done up in Montana. The local commissioners here had this great master plan where they were going to try to reward ranchers for holding on to land and keeping it open space. And they had this title development rezoning plan where you could buy somebody's building rights, essentially stripping their land and putting it into somewhat of a conservation easement, so to speak. But the value of that was negotiated between you and the developer. What ended up happening is developers would come in and they would buy, you know, quite a few. And then they would go to the county and they'd go, man, we just spent all this money and we still need X amount more. And they'd say, oh, well, that's good enough. And before you know it, that program has no legs anymore because they just cut the knees right out from underneath it. And we don't have a lot of money for conservation easements, which I'm all for conservation easements. I think that when you're trying to run a ranch business and land values are 20 plus thousand an acre, there's no way to make that go in the cattle industry. And so if you can find a way to sell that development right and get the values down to an ag value, hey, that's great. And I don't know, do you guys deal with issues with processing? You know, because we have nowhere to take our cattle to process. That's the other big thing, local communities around here.
We have this next podcast episode coming up after you. We have OCM, the Organization for Competitive Markets.
Yep.
They are coming on to talk about local processing and where that's at today in response to what we've seen through supply chains and packer consolidation. So that'll be an interesting conversation here regionally in Montana. I mean, you know, like Nevada, we're pretty isolated, and it's just, you're still going to sell your calves to a feeder in Colorado, Nebraska, or Iowa. You're going to get what you get on the cash market. And there's always talk of local processors coming along and disrupting the market. But I'm pretty jaded on that ever happening. I mean, I'm 35 now, and that seems to come up every 4 or 5 years as someone comes to town, town being all of Montana, and they and they pitch this grandiose 20 million, 100 million, 200 million idea of a packer. And it makes sense in theory, but it, you know, I think you guys are still going to sell calves into feeders in Washington and California, and we're still going to sell feeders into Colorado and Iowa.
Yeah. And when I got into the regenerative ag stuff, I looked at it because I was a stalker guy and we ran quite a few thousand yearlings, and I love yearlings. That's like, I don't know why, I just love yearlings. Cow calf's great, but I love being in the yearling business. And maybe it's because I enjoy doctoring yearlings. I don't know, but
that's like having a bunch of kids around. They got all that personality and some attitude, and yeah, their yearlings are fun.
Yeah, I thought when I got into the regenerative thing, I started with the Savory Institute and their Land to Market program, and one of the heads of the hub that I was linked with, I mean, he is a hell of a cowboy, and he's been on the big ranches, and you know, he's just a very knowledgeable guy. I thought that I was going to find a way that I could be the grass feedlot, you know, and I had done all the studying on when I needed to finish cattle on the grass that I have, so I had the right protein, sugar, carbohydrate contents, the works. And I was like, oh, this is going to be amazing. And like you said, then it was, okay, there's no packing house to go to, or we're too far away for this, and we're too far away. So again, yeah, we're stuck in the commercial market, and the yearling market spanked us a couple of times. And so we're there, but we definitely are still doing cow-calf now and more focused on that. And then working on how we can retain ownership into yearlings and go that route. But
back to a ranch investing podcast, having a premium market within a decent proximity does affect, it does positively affect land values. Not that you and I or any of the buyers out there are wanting to see land values go any higher, but I mean, I'm indifferent because I'm just transactional, right? I'm just a sleaze bag who gets the sale, whether the market's up or down. But no, if you see it with like sugar beet processors, that's a very local commodity, cash crop, high valued. That does positively affect land values. We just saw one fail, a co-op of sugar producers, sugar beets in Northeast Montana, and that'll certainly have a downward effect on land values there. So maybe if someone's looking for irrigated row crop in Montana, be looking in Northeast Montana, there might be some deals there. But how do you manage a dynamic stocking operation when Nevada is 98% government owned?
a lot of private party leases, you know, and I know guys that have worked with the government entities and done a lot of their own monitoring and been able to change stocking rates or get things, opened up a little bit by showing, hey, we can do this. This is what we've been studying for the last 5 years. Here's all of our data. And it's kind of hard to argue with good science. Because it makes sense logically. You can't go into the same space with the same number of animals every time the same year. There's too many variables. But I run my business almost entirely on private leases. And it's a lot more expensive, but it's a lot easier to manage. I can tell you that. And we have a lot of flood irrigated ground here. That's our valley is primarily flood irrigated. And I do run on a couple pivots.
Your private grazing must be primarily irrigated grass.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got some properties that have some sage, some hillside that go up, and you get a lot of the Great Basin rye that comes up there. So if you plan it right, you can get cattle up there in the spring and get some good grazing on it and then get them off. And I think that as some of these ranches get broken up, that's where you're going to see more of the housing stuff. You know, when you see people coming from California, they look at this country and they see it wide open. And the reason they see it wide open is when you look at California, when you go over the hill, if there's a hillside, there's a house on it. And we're built in the flats primarily, and there isn't a whole lot on our hillsides yet. And so I think that's coming, whether we want it or not. And it might be a saving grace because it might keep some of our grazing land, some of the good grassland open.
Oh, I'm sure just like Southeast Wyoming, so Torrington, Cheyenne, they had an influx of Coloradans because of political disagreements. People wanted to live in Wyoming for no income tax. Property taxes are about comparable, but then political security, and then you had a lot of influx into Southeast Wyoming from Nebraska, which has some of the worst property taxes in the nation. So there's always that trade-off, and it's easy to make that leap when you're only moving within 2 hours. And I can see you guys, Nevada, not having, I believe they don't have corporate income tax. Nevada is trying to attract corporations, and they're doing a good job, like Tesla, you know, has a big plant, I think, in Reno. And you see a lot of entrepreneurs moving to Vegas and flying to their office in LA or San Francisco on a daily basis. So Nevada is going to be attracting people of all income levels, and that's going to definitely grow the land, grow the market of the land you're competing for.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it was weird. You guys talked about it on an earlier podcast, that influx of everybody running to buy ranch land. And I don't know if it was the Yellowstone effect, but I can tell you one thing. When we were right in the middle of that because of our proximity. You can fly out of the local airport here in Minden. I know guys that fly back and forth to LA on almost daily. And it's an hour flight from here, an hour flight to San Francisco to LA, you know, so we're geographically accessible for a lot of people that have the means to do that type of traveling, and with no state income tax, and it is gorgeous. It certainly has a lot of appeal to buyers. The hard part comes in with availability of land. And one of the things that our county has done is, and I don't know how they do it in Montana, but here they basically said, hey, you can't subdivide agricultural land below 19 acres, which in theory sounds amazing. It's kind of a hard place because 20 acres isn't quite big enough to really run anything commercial on. But it's also small enough that it makes getting water usage pretty difficult when you're dealing with 10, 15 people off of one ditch or things like that. So, there's pros and cons to everything, like you've said. And I think that in our market right now, the hard part for buyers is finding something that is priced appropriately, that gives them the location that they want, that has the utilities and accessibility that they want. And it's hard to come by here.
Yeah. So my question also, why I wanted to have you on, Jason, my interest in Nevada, is I have heard about investors taking advantage of PRF, pasture range forage, that there's about and I'm going to make you spill the beans. You're going to have to divulge.
I don't know if I can help here. So, you know,
this being a legitimate thing, but they've used government subsidized pasture range forage insurance through RMA, Risk Management Agency, which is within the USDA. Anyways, yep. It's about a 300% payout. So it's an ATM machine. Every dollar you put in, you get three out. And I've heard Nevada is the best in the nation for that payout. And people figure that out. Have you seen investors like from a desk somewhere else in the United States put this on a spreadsheet and say, all right, let's go buy some Nevada ranches with huge BLM allotments?
It's not something that they're buying properties for. You know, they're not looking at that going, okay, I can do this, and this is where I'm going to be looking to make my income. There's a juxtaposition here between the investors and the big businesses coming in, because a lot of these investors, you know, if you're talking these big ranches that are out there in Elko, Ely, places like that, I mean, Elko, Winnemucca, there's a lot of mines, a lot of mining corporations that own that land, and they manage the ranches on them to help keep the land in good shape. You know, as you're well aware, ranchers do a lot of work to keep things upkept and for the benefit of the public and the owners. So there's that aspect of it. And so when you're competing with corporations like that, I don't know that is really going to register high on their list of why I'm going to buy a property. When you're looking at the small-time investor, I think they're looking at it going, hey, what's this land going to be worth in 5-10 years? And yeah, it comes into play. I've seen it more come into play with ranchers that, you know, because most of us have to run on both sides of the hill. And when I say hill, I mean the Sierra Nevada mountains. So California, Nevada, there's a lot of guys that run back and forth. And so I see the biggest thing is for them, it's almost a risk mitigation to say, hey, look, like I'm going to take this risk and stock this place. I'm buying a bunch of animals to stock this ranch in Nevada. Oh no, we didn't get any rain. You know, now I'm going to cash in my ticket with the USDA for the insurance that I bought for no rain and things like that. I've seen it more on the rancher level than the investor level. And but it also helps some of these ranchers because the land values are so expensive here. You know, people are charging a lot of money to manage and graze cattle over here. So it helps offset that cost. You know, I don't know what you guys are charging a pair, but I'm almost scared to say what we charge a pair here in this valley for managed on pasture ground.
Well, I don't know what you mean by managed, but your flat AUM rate here for summer grazing a pair, and that's no landowner does not provide fencing, salt, water. It's just you provide all the labor. You're leasing the grass. You're paying for consumption of grass with a pair. That's going to be anywhere from 25 to 30 bucks an AUM. Well, I should say pair because that's not an AUM, but yeah, 25 to 30 a pair per month. And there's definitely sweetheart deals out there in the rougher country where a cow has to travel further to get a drink of water. You're going to be down to 20. But yeah, that's kind of the going rate. You haven't even seen that affected too much by high calf prices and inflation. I was expecting these rates to jump up to 40, 35 and 40. And I mean, good for the operator. Haven't really seen a big leap.
Yeah. So what we've seen a lot here is that a ranch owner may have a lease to somebody and that person says, hey, look, I'm not going to stock fully this year for whatever reason, inflation or they were culling herd size hard, something like that. And they might bring somebody in to fill the majority of their lease up and manage those animals for that person. And we're seeing prices significantly higher than that. But just for grass consumption on these irrigated pasture ground, yeah, I mean, you're right now I'm hearing anywhere from $40 to $50 just to be able to turn your pair out for the summer and still have to fix fence and still have to put salt out and have to get over here and check them and make sure they're healthy. So it's a premium. That's as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. I wonder if you are closer to better markets, because that sounds like South Dakota and Nebraska rates. They are definitely paying that, whereas Montana we're not, but we're not close to feeders and packers. And maybe your proximity to California and the feeders in Oregon and Washington does command that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, we are close to Harris. You know, Harris is right over the hill a couple hours away. So I know when I was selling yearlings, a lot of the time, and I know there's still guys that have deals with Harris that have had deals with them for 20 years, that they just sell their calves to them. And they come out, they negotiate a rate, and they're never hitting the video markets or the sale yards. I do know that we do have a good amount of different packers that come in and buy from the sale yards and from the video markets. When I was selling yearlings, the majority of my stuff went to Washington, Idaho, and California. Those were my three.
Yeah, definitely Southern Idaho, a lot, big feedlots there with,
Simplot's there.
Simplot, J.R. Simplot. What an American success story. What an amazing man. He has a quote that only in America can a barefoot farm boy become a billionaire. And that's true. That's his story. I got a question. You being regenerative and holistic practitioner, where are you at with all the cheatgrass in the Great Basin? How do you deal with that?
There's obviously people a lot more qualified to answer that than me, but my view on it, I kind of liked what Alan Savory said a long time ago. He had a YouTuber. He was talking about if you could just take a million animals and graze them through the state of Nevada, what it would do to the landscape. And it would be pretty incredible. That being said, if my view on it is it's palatable for these cows when it's young and it's coming up in the spring. And, you know, I don't know in the succession, in the hierarchy of plants, where it sits, you know, with the root systems. But I do know that if you can get it grazed and grazed back, that it does allow for some other grasses to come in, the perennial rye grasses and things like that. Again, it's hard to manage when you're told that you can only go places at a certain time of the year and you can only have a certain amount of animals. It's hard to force competition and things like that. That's part of why I like the whole stalker deal is, you know, if you have a bad year, and what a ranch that let's say could hold 1,000 head of yearlings now can only hold 700. Well, you're not going, okay, now I got to sell 300 of my best cows or, you know, 300 of my bottom end or whatever it is at the mercy of the market. You're just going to stock appropriately. And then you can force the competition on feed. That being said too, I'm a first generation rancher. So when I came into ranching, I didn't have anything to inherit. So I had to jump in and go, okay, I'm going to have to partner up with the bank. And for better or for worse, my dad and myself are business partners on this. And we just said, fuck it. We're going to go in. I apologize for swearing on your podcast. F it. We're going to go in so deep that the bank isn't our lender. They're now our business partner. And, you know, now they need us to succeed. So we dove in, and the holistic management was a way that we could try to increase our stocking rate and increase the economics of it. I've done a lot of classes with a lot of the different, you know, HMIs, savories, things like that. I think that there's some incredible information out there. I just have a hard time drinking all of the Kool-Aid from one or the other. You know, I think that every ranch is so dynamic, every business is so dynamic that the one size fits all approach is impossible, but they market it really, really well. So, as far as the cheatgrass is concerned, to get back to your question, I'm not the expert on that, but just in a grazing, you know, logic standpoint, that's where I would go with it.
The old strategy of borrow so much money that if you go down, we're going down together.
That's exactly right. And that's what we did is we just said, you know what, when you're buying ranches at residential development prices, I mean, there's no way. And we had a piece of property here that we identified that was between two conservation easements. And we said, you know, if we can link this up, man, wouldn't that be great? And we weren't able to pull it off. We ended up selling part of it and we lease it back, which was, you know, the best of all possibilities. With no risk, you'll get no reward. So we swung for the fences and it's allowed us to build the business where we've got going.
So I put this question on Facebook once many years ago. What is big country? You know, people talk about, well, that's big country. This is big country. And I was like, well, what is big country? I don't even know what the standard there would be. And one guy said, it's the distance between fence lines. And I thought that was probably a pretty good definition. And we always think of Nevada, the Great Basin, as big country. It's huge pastures, the distance between fences.
And it is everywhere but here. So this ground here is small ranches, small pastures. The way I've associated it is said, we're basically a grass feedlot. You know, we can operate these ranches in the same space as a commercial feedlot, essentially, not with the same stocking rates, of course, but, you know, to me, big country is you go out to Winnemucca, Lovelock, Golconda, those areas where you see these big ranches like the Sea Punch and, you know, the Spanish Ranch and, you know, the Wine Cup and all of those. Those are big country ranches. We are mere poodle pups with what we are running on. And, you know, my ranch manager, he came to me from a big ranch in Austin. And his dogs were used to doing massive outruns. I mean, they are dirty, tough dogs. He has a lot of Idaho shag dogs. And it was the first time this year he came to me and he goes, I'm looking for some border collies now. He goes, I don't need the big, dirty, tough dogs in the country we're in. We're in little country. And we're not big country. I don't care what anybody says. Our biggest country is still average or small in relation to what I consider big country.
Well, with you not being that that part of Nevada, sounds like you might be in a higher precip area, probably a little. I mean, definitely sounds like amenities. It's pretty. There's water to work with and mountains nearby. And there's a Costco within, you know, you don't have to travel 2 hours for a Costco. Do you still, as a stalker operator, see a future? And as a regenerative practitioner, is there a need or a future for electronic fencing in your operation, vents, collars? There would be for the big country. That seems like an easy low-hanging fruit, but how about on the irrigated pastures?
You know, it depends on what you want out of the pasture. A lot of guys still run set stock here. You know, I'm the weird outlier that is, I'm the weird practitioner. I used electric fencing a lot when you come into some of these ranches that are, you know, 700, 1,000 acres, small ranches, and you don't know where to put a fence line up. And you're like, hey, I got to find a way to get some different pastures out of this because I can't run this set stock. I'm just not producing enough with the stocking rate. And electric fence has been really helpful in going, okay, this works, this didn't. I love and hate it. I found that running yearlings every day, I was getting electrocuted fixing electric fence. They're constantly through it. On the other hand, it definitely serves a purpose. If you can train cattle to it and they learn to respect it, I've seen some phenomenal results with it. I think it would be hard to use in the big country because when you're talking about, hey, I got to run an electric fence for 10 miles or more, how do you figure out where the short is on that? And, and getting it strung and...
Yeah, the electric fence. I was referring to electronic collars, the digital fence.
Oh, okay.
Virtual fencing.
Yeah, okay. You know what? I have not used them. I've seen some stuff about them. And my thought has always been, with these animals, if there's no clear barrier, my fear on these smaller places is they hit that jolt, they go the wrong direction. At some point, does it stop them from going to get the ice cream on the other side of that virtual fence? I don't know. It would be an interesting thing to check. One of the things that I thought was interesting, I had somebody come to me with a prototype ear tag that was monitoring heat from these animals and like temperature. And, you could basically see if somebody in your herd was abnormally hot, without having to go out there. Seemed pretty cool. Doesn't benefit me because I think part of seeing if cattle are sick is actually being able to look them in the eye and actually see them, not just see a temperature spike. I don't know if they were running around for 5-10 minutes on a 100-degree day.
The virtual fencing, I'd like to see it tested out. I'd like to hear other people's experience with it first, because that learning curve is a challenge. And like you said, with electric fencing, as a lot of us have moved to, when you do more rotations, there's no other choice. You're going to be learning that trade and the tricks, the life hacks of electric fencing, which there are many to learn. And it's a steep curve for the cows and the people. I recall when I was getting started with it, I wanted to teach my bitches a lesson and make them respect that electric fence. So I would always I'd have like a copper ground as deep as I could get it, 4 feet, 5 feet, just however deep I needed to get, like 7 joules, and pump that thing up as high as it would go to teach them a lesson. But I was dumb enough to think that leather gloves are an insulator. I just some days have it in my mind that I'm right, and there's no other considerations to be made. And I walked up and I grabbed that thing with leather gloves on, and I thought I was on a hospital bed getting a defibrillator. It was just, my chest went, you know, it was like reset the old heartbeat on me. It was knocked you on your ass.
Yeah. Try doing that in irrigated wet ground. There's nothing to save you. The worst is, and I've had it happen with, you know, yearlings are terrible, because when I was running yearlings, I was constantly buying and selling, you know? And so, you have these animals for 60, 90 days. By the time they get trained to a hot fence, you know, they're gone. And now you're bringing something in. There's always one asshole in every bunch that's going to rip it down. And so you're riding out checking stuff, and you're in irrigated ground, and you're like, okay, I'm going to go hobble my horse real far away, and I'm going to use my shaps, my Armitas, whatever you have. And you're going to try to fix fence, you know, with roping gloves, your leather shaps, and whatever you have on you. And there's no way you're not getting electrocuted. It just doesn't not happen. I'd be really interested to see what would happen with the electronic collars, the virtual fencing. I know it has not worked well for some of my neighbors with their dogs. So I'm wondering, you know, with cattle, how that would work, and the costs associated with getting something like that set up.
Yeah. I mean, the alternative with grazing irrigated grass, electric fence, we also flood irrigate hay grass pastures and graze it out. And so we have barbed wire fence, of course, around all of our ditches and pastures. And that means every year you'd have to get a new pair of lacrosse boots, because they're inevitably, you could be as careful as you know, you're most careful, you're going to get your lacrosse boot cut on the barbed wire fence. And halfway through the season of irrigating and grazing, flood irrigating, you'd be like, screw it, my socks are wet every time, I'm just going to start wearing an old pair of like Converse All-Stars or something, because I'm going through a new pair of lacrosses every year. This is getting ridiculous.
I've got my Van slip-ons, my trusty Van slip-ons. When they get too dirty from doing chores in them, then they become the irrigation shoes. And, you know, I'm out there with my white legs in the sun and a pair of shorts, with my Vans. But yeah, it's, you know, I'm fortunate. My ranch manager really does take care of a lot of stuff for me. And the one thing that sucks is he's 6'6", 6'7". And so he can step over fences, you know, he's all leg. And I'm not that tall. I'm under 6 foot tall. So for me, it sucks, because he'll step right over a fence and he'll say, follow me. And I'm like, I'll have to walk a mile to go to the gate, or, you know, I got to go find a brace post that I can climb, because I'm not following you over it. But yeah, the going through irrigation boots has become a constant. What you don't tear, inevitably just the quality of stuff has gone so downhill that they fall apart. And yeah, it's a new pair every year. And for that poor man, I would buy chest waders and he'd just wear them around his waist.
So, well, as we get close to wrapping this up, Jason, I want you to take some of the investors and buyers from Montana and send them your way. Tell us where are the elk in Nevada?
If I do that, my father-in-law will kill me. He's an avid hunter. You know, that's actually one of our big problems here, is the draw system. I don't know if you guys have an issue with that, but
the worst in the nation. Montana is terrible.
Yeah. Well, I would say then we're close behind you, because I've got guys that just, they put in every year, they're not getting anything. And I don't have time between the real estate brokerage and the ranch business. I don't have time to go and scout, and I don't want to waste, you know, a tag and be that guy that goes out and just goes, oh yeah, I got a week, I'm going to go hunt, and not have planned where I'm going to go and have the resources. And, but I do know that, Eastern Nevada is, you know, the spot for that. And, you know, good luck getting a tag for it, or you're going to pay a pretty penny for a landowner tag if you can even find one of those. So yeah, it's a tough cookie on that.
Any decent state programs, like Colorado has Ranching for Wildlife, where you have different grazing management, seasonal use practices with sheep, livestock, cattle, and then you're rewarded with pretty high value landowner tags, marketable, merchantable tags. Wyoming does a pretty good job. New Mexico has some merchantable tags, but Colorado seems to be attaching livestock conservation to wildlife recreation. Anything like that going to come up in Nevada?
Man, it would be nice to see. I haven't seen any of those programs. That doesn't mean they're not there. Like I said, you know, where I'm in the northwest part of the state, I do real estate transactions, you know, throughout the state, with especially with ranch properties. But with what I'm dealing with, typically I'm not privy to what's going on the BLM stuff. A lot of these ranches will sell, and then they've already got somebody who's taking over the permits that they have in place with grazing, via family or something like that. That seems to be the affordable way to graze. If I could graze outside year round, man, that would be a treat. I can tell you that.
Yeah, that would be ideal.
Yeah. Well,
Jason, any plugs, any final plugs? What's your ideal client? What are you working on? What can you provide the listeners across the nation? Other than, I do want to say for my Texas listeners, Jason's cowboy hat is way better than your Texas hats. because the Texans, I have a what I call like a Great Basin fedora, you know, a flat brim type hat. And boy, did they ever give me shit for that. And they just think it should be more like a taco.
Tacos are for eating, not for wearing. And, you know, I will say this, it's real nice to have a shade on all sides of my head, not just the front and the back. But yeah, this is my least Great Basin style hat. So anyways, that being said, as far as ideal clients, right now what we're seeing is some very large ranch properties that have developable possibility. So it's going to be somebody who wants a 10, 20 year play on doing some development and doing cluster development with keeping ranch land open around it, and creating a, whether it be a an operational agreement on a lease, who's going to run it or co-op that between the owners, could actually be done really, really easily. But right now what we're seeing is some of the best land in the valley, oldest water rights, most productive ground, both hay ground and otherwise, are on the market. And the ask for what somebody's going to spend for, you know, $100 million for one of these ranches, you're not going to see an ROI in cattle grazing. But the long-term investment play is, how can I set this up? Which parcels are developable? How can I set up maybe doing some cluster development for some high-end homes, and then keeping the open space and allowing for some grazing management? Because I think that a home on every 20 acres is actually more detrimental than taking 5 or 10 acres, putting a cluster of homes and allowing open space to be undisturbed. But yeah, my ideal client right now is just people who are looking to land bank. essentially. People who see the value in a commodity that we're not making more of. And this valley only has so much available. And I get a lot of California horse clientele. You know, people coming in from out of state that, hey, we want a property. We have five horses. We need a barn. We need this. We need that. And, you know, I love selling land, but I love that I get to look at really cool architecture and some historical homes when I get to go look at these older ranches. So, yeah, anybody who's looking.
I think you're on to something there. The cluster development is new to me. Some people have sent me things on that recently, and I like it. I mean, I'm with you. I would like to see as much of our highly valuable farm and ranch land stay intact for production reasons, economic reasons, cultural, societal. But then you also have the value of the view shed. And as you mentioned, you take 2,000 acre irrigated pasture ranch and you just chop it up into 120 acre home sites. That is a ecological disaster. That is an absolute, I mean, that's worse than monoculture corn, row corn. And and a lot of those become horse ghettos. They just become overgrazed, weedy horse ghettos. And I do like this idea of cluster development. So maybe if we have any listeners out there, they can ask you to consult for them. I think it's great. You will enhance the value of each home by having that view shed. Those homes will be more desirable and more valuable in the future. So what you're giving up, you know, say of the 2,000 acre ranch, rather than subdividing it 100% through, you've clustered it. And say you have 1,000 acres of open space, what you're giving up on that 1,000 acres is going to see value in those other homes. That will have long-term benefits.
Yeah, and that's actually where I want to talk to you about the crowdfunding side of things that you've been working on. And when you invited me on, I was like, I don't really know why he wants me to come talk to him, but I want to ask him questions. So once we're done with the podcast, I'm certainly going to be picking your brain on that aspect, because I think that, again, the fractionalized ownership for buying something like that and then doing those clustered developments, if it can be done in a way that the liquidity is set up, you know, hey, you're going to see liquidity in 7, 10, 15, 20 years on how this is laid out on the development side of things, there could be a really good opportunity for people to have a great investment at the same time also get some benefit of ranch land ownership. And I mean, like you said, all of the intangible sides of it are very real. And I think that when people buy 20 acres, it's almost overwhelming when they don't have a background in it. They go, what do I do with 20 acres? My house is on 2. Do I mow everything? Do I graze it? How many fences do I have to build? They don't want to deal with that headache. They want their 5,000 square foot beautiful home and things to be taken care of for them. And so I think this this cluster development where you're on a couple of acres, but you have privacy and a view shed allows that, you know, and it gives people the best of both worlds. And if you do it right, you can set up a community that has, hey, here's the community riding arena. Here's the, you know, the trails. Here's the, you know, all of the things that I think are important. And one of them being the agritourism side of things that this valley hasn't seen. And I don't know if it's something that's happening up there, but I'm seeing a boom in agritourism and I'm not sure how it's going to work in this valley with all of the, you know, local government restrictions, but certainly something that I think is going to bring value into parcel ownership.
We have excellent protections and regulations around agritourism. Like Montana is just set up for it very well. There's just not a huge demand for it. It's one of those novelty bills, regulations, laws that there's really no need for it. We don't have a huge agritourism industry. It's because we're just so seasonal. I mean, we have 16 months of winter here
It felt like that here this winter. This was the first real winter we had. We had snow just constant. But, you know, one of the things is we're so close to Lake Tahoe and we're so close to Reno that, you know, if you can set people up and you can say, hey, you want to come look at a ranch? Yeah, we can get you on a horse and you can go play cowboy for half a day, for a day. There's a benefit there to the casinos because now people are sticking around longer. They're staying in their hotels a day longer. There's more to do. I think the demand's there. I also think that the educational side of it is when you can bring people out, the disconnect, you know, I grew up in Southern California. I know the disconnect. I talk with friends that I grew up with and where I am now versus what they think of the industry that I'm in. And so being able to get people onto ranches and allow them to see what actually happens, it changes the perspective. And I do think it adds to value in long-term placement of a piece of land because people appreciate it that much more.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for coming on, Jason. How can someone get a hold of you?
How would they like to get a hold of me? I can give them my cell phone number, or if they want, I can give them my website. But my cell phone is area code 310-600-0065. And if anybody has any interest in land in Northern Nevada, whether it be horse property, ranch property, or luxury property, feel free to give me a call. We've got a great team of agents here and we can serve pretty much anybody. It's inkrealty.com. I-N-K. I-N-K. Like we ink a deal.
Inkrealty.com. Well, Jason Kent, regenerative holistic practitioner, broker, cowboy aficionado. Thanks for coming on.
Click subscribe on your streaming platform so you know when the latest episode has dropped. Be the source of knowledge and the maven that other professionals are excited to refer.